Welcome to Philosophy at Guelph, a monthly podcast and interviews with philosophers in and visiting the Department of Philosophy at the University of Guelph. I'm John Hacker-Wright, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at the University of Guelph, and today I'm going to be interviewing John Russon, Professor of Philosophy here at Guelph. Professor Russon does original philosophical work influenced by ancient philosophy, as well as 19th century and contemporary European philosophy. He's the author of several books, including most recently, Human Experience and Bearing Witness to Epiphany. He has a forthcoming book entitled Sites of Exposure. Recently, John traveled to India by invitation to talk philosophy in several cities across India. His recent work addresses issues of multiculturalism. Today, we will be discussing his recent work on multiculturalism, but before we do that, I want to ask John about some general philosophical issues. To start with, what, in your view, does a philosopher do?
A philosophy, I think, is really just a matter of having a questioning attitude towards our own existence and towards our own experience, and really trying to understand, what am I seeing, or what am I doing, or what's going on here? So in a way, I think of philosophy itself as just the most basic attitude we could have of trying to make sense of our world. But in that sense, many of our human endeavors are philosophical. The sciences are, the arts are, and so on. So I think that philosophy, on the one hand, is that basic attitude, and in its history, it has given rise to many of these very activities. I think that the impulse behind scientific revolutions, artistic revolutions, and so on is often philosophical. So I think that what the philosopher does then is really, in a sort of serious and committed way, pursue this kind of querying of the nature of our existence, typically through any of those means. I guess I have two things to know. First, I would note that the philosophical enterprise is creative. So I think in the 1600s, to approach the world from the point of view of the emerging science of Galileo and Copernicus, Descartes, Bacon, and Newton was amazingly creative. And people who were engaged in that were involved in a revolutionary kind of thinking that transformed the experience of the world in all kinds of ways, political, intellectual, and all the rest. In 2011, to approach the world from the point of view of the basic principles of contemporary physics or chemistry is not so creative and revolutionary. It's now very much an established thing. And so I think the sciences and the arts, various other things that have developed, when they have emerged, have often been the cutting edge of philosophy. Whereas now, it might often be more philosophical to have an attitude of questioning those ideas, wondering, what am I doing when I'm doing science? What am I doing when I'm engaged in this? So I think the philosophical impulse is the same, but philosophical impulse realized in 2011 is different than in 1600s. And I think also, since the real beginnings of a kind of organized human practice of engaging in a sort of systematic question of the world, a massive tradition of philosophizing has developed. To really be called a philosopher today, I mean, in a very personal way, you're a philosopher, I think, if you're just thinking about your existence and wondering how to live your life. But in a really disciplined and developed way, or in a way that has chosen philosophy as a vocation, in the modern world, it means having digested a good portion of this accumulated wisdom and insight of 2,500 or 3,000 years of human practice. I'll just say one more thing about that. I think that what that really amounts to now is a practice of trying to appreciate the wealth of human accomplishment and trying to appreciate in what sense the different things that people do are wisdom, in what sense political organization reflects wisdom, in what sense work in the fine arts reflects wisdom, in what sense religious practices reflect wisdom, in what sense family life and personal practices reflect wisdom. And to assess that well, to have a reasonable judgment about how these things are wise and to shape one's own living and thinking by that wisdom requires a great deal of study. It requires a great deal of appreciation of exactly those domains. What are people really doing when they're doing religion? What are people really doing when they're doing art? And so to be a philosopher now, I think, to be a good philosopher now, one needs to be pretty broadly learned in the different domains of human endeavor. And basically, one needs to cultivate an attitude of appreciating those things, trying to understand the strength and power of those activities, and then along with that, cultivating a critical attitude that is prepared to recognize the limit of these various forms of human endeavor as well as their strengths and resources. So in short, I think philosophy is just questioning our existence, and it's nothing more than trying to heighten the powers of perception we live by all the time. But as a advanced discipline, it really requires a strong commitment to the history of philosophical thinking and to appreciating the history of the whole range of cultivated human endeavors of science and art and so on.
So just to follow that up to see if I've understood, a professional philosopher does just the same thing that an ordinary human being practicing philosophy, questioning their existence, does, qualitatively the same. They just do it in a particularly focused and concentrated
yeah.
way.
Well, I would hope in a highly educated way. So, you know, when you're approaching philosophical questions for the first time, I mean, there can be a kind of beautiful naivete to that when you really wonder, you know, what is the meaning of life? How should I live? And you're really open to the questionable character of that, by which I mean the way in which there isn't an easy or obvious answer. So that's great. And you can ask questions like, what is knowledge or what is reality? And those things can really confront you with their mystery and their wonder. And that's really wonderful. But it's also the case that when one starts with those things, one has relatively few resources for moving with those ideas. And in fact, let's say 2,500 years of brilliant culture of people grappling with those questions has produced amazing insights. And so there really is a lot to learn about all of those questions. So a professional philosopher, I would hope, has spent decades cultivating quite a refined and subtle appreciation of the 2,000 years of insight that people have developed about these questions, such that one isn't left just with a question where you have no resources to move, but in fact, where you can be articulate and insightful about how to answer that question, especially to differentiate wisely between the different alternatives with which one will be confronted by the world. So, you know, every advertising slogan will give you an answer to how to live your life. Every TV show will. Everybody's mother or father will have advice for you on how to live your life. All your friends will. Every job will say, do this, make money, you know, be rich, or travel the world and see things. Like, you're surrounded by all kinds of answers. So you will be confronted with those. You will have to make decisions. I would hope that someone who has studied this has resources for moving intelligently between those things and formulating powerfully how to think about those questions, how to answer them, and can then communicate that to other people. So I think of philosophers, professional philosophers, there are many things that make a professional philosopher, but more than anything else, I think of a professional philosopher as someone who is responsible for carrying on for the rest of the world the brilliant traditions of wisdom, the brilliant traditions of human insight, and representing the wealth and the power of that discipline to the rest of the people in society who don't have 20 years to spend studying these books. That's what I think our mission is, I mean, the mission of those of us who teach philosophy in philosophy departments. I think it's great if individual people are themselves brilliant and original philosophers, but I don't think that's what being a professional philosopher is primarily about. I think it's like being a physicist or like being an economist. It's basically about taking on the responsibilities of carrying on and representing a human tradition and a human discipline that is much bigger than any person could ever accomplish. So in that way, I think being a professional philosopher is fundamentally to be a kind of teacher, to be someone who is going to take on the role of handing down to the next generation what has been handed down over the last 2,500 years. So yes, it is the same as what the average person on the street does when they ask questions, but I hope that we do it in a way that has really gained something from a couple of decades of apprenticeship to the brightest minds of human history.
So you present the professional philosopher as someone who's really broadly learned, but it seems that professional philosophy, as other disciplines today, are demanding an exceptional amount of specialization, and so it seems more and more that the profession demands that we be very, very narrowly focused. And to some extent, that requires perhaps some neglect of the broadening that you talk about.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think the specialization you talk about is both for good and for bad. So I think, first of all, for good, yes. I mean, we should recognize that 2,000 years of thinking about difficult issues has produced a lot of learning and a lot of subtlety and a lot of technicality. And therefore, there's as much reason to specialize in philosophy as there is in chemistry. Or as there is in mathematics, or as there is in economics. There is a real subject matter, in other words. There's a body of work to be mastered and all kinds of questions, research directions to pursue. So it very much is the case that becoming an expert in this field does mean becoming specialized. So I think on the one hand, that is a very good thing. It should be expected and should be appreciated. And so it's great, for example, in a philosophy department, such as we have here at Guelph, to have, you know, roughly 20 faculty members, each of whom has a very cultivated specialty. So there may be a couple of people who specialize in different kinds of ethics. There may be a couple of people who specialize in ancient philosophy. You know, so in other words, there might be some overlap, but basically, each of us is doing something quite singular. That is really the route that we have come to through, you know, carefully refining our studies in these areas. And that makes for a vibrant and exciting educational environment. I think that it means that the individual work that each individual faculty member is doing is making a worthwhile contribution to some branch of study. It means there's real life in the department, where it's not just the handing down of a single prepackaged set of lessons, but it's a whole bunch of people with very different commitments who are trying to offer to students a vision of why it's valuable to think this way. Somebody else is thinking about why it's valuable to think this way. And so we have quite a dynamic philosophical dialogue happening in a university department that has such a varied body of people. So anyway, I think that's great. I think it's great for the students. I think it's great for us as faculty members and so on. It's great for the university. It's great for the discipline. The negative side of it is that I think that there is something fundamentally important about breadth, you know, about appreciation of the depth and of the tradition and so on. And I think it is true that the demands of the job market in philosophy, the demands of completing the requirements of PhDs and so on, which themselves are tied into other kinds of economic and other sorts of demands within the university, I think it's very much true that those things do encourage and, in a sense, sort of fetishize, you might say, specialization at the expense of breadth and depth. And, you know, the tradition of learning ends up being treated as if, you know, a little basic dabbling in that, and everybody knows the basic stuff, but now we should do some cutting-edge modern stuff. And I think that's a very poor attitude. I think, on the contrary, the reason that that things count as philosophy in our tradition is because they are works of inexhaustible depth. And so the philosophical education will always be returning to St. Thomas Aquinas or Heraclitus, Locke. Like these figures from all over the world have offered insights that will never be worn out. They speak of ideas that people can always learn from. And so I think while it's great for people to be pushing on and doing new and specialized things, there is something really lost if we don't maintain a strong engagement with that history. And I think that there is a lot of current sort of rhetoric that treats that as old stuff, easily mastered, let's get on to the new thing, which I think is a mistake. And I also think that in other ways, professionally, we're really oriented towards a model of research and accomplishment that, if it's suited to anything, is better suited to the natural sciences or studies in technology. So we're supposed to be producing, you know, regular research results, and I just don't think that's the kind of thing that philosophy does exactly. So we are supposed to publish a certain number of articles every year and have, you know, exciting new original ideas and so on. It just seems like it's a kind of simple-minded way of looking at what philosophy does. And the result is that in our careers, we are forced to try to do these things to meet the standards of professional success, where often those practices we engage in work counter to a real cultivation of a good education. So that sometimes that means that we are sort of inhibited and restricted by the demands of our institutions, even though we would like to do otherwise, but sometimes it actually shapes our own perceptions and we actually start to believe, oh, that's really how philosophy should be done. It really is a matter of being a philosopher to debate with yourself and with others about what philosophy is, and amongst our own colleagues, perhaps even between you and me, you know, we might really have different views about which of these practices are more sort of authentically or powerfully philosophical and which are more vices or something like that. But anyway, so yes, I think the specialization is proper and important. Now, I have specializations in 20th century phenomenology, Hegel, the 19th century German philosopher, things that I've mostly worked on, and even within those figures, there are sort of sub things that I really am focused on, nature of self-consciousness or nature of knowledge, whatever, various things. I think that's a very good thing. So I think that's right, but I do also think that there is a culture of specialization which runs hand in hand with the culture of emphasizing quantifiable research products that work counter to the real life of philosophy.
So if it were, as it should be ideally in your view, it would be a matter of maybe more prolonged learning and fewer quote-unquote results.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, we live in an environment that's very driven by money. So universities, on one hand, are educational institutions in the sense that that's where people go for education. But they're not always educational institutions in the sense that people running them are oriented primarily or sometimes perhaps even at all by educational goals, but oftentimes they no doubt are. But concerns can really, really be wrapped up in budgets. And so, for example, Your budget's always going to work out better if you pay out less in salaries and bring in more in fees. So if you can up the number of students without upping the number of faculty, you'll have people who teach larger classes, your balance books will look better. You'll be bringing in more money and putting out less. So that, of course, is what happens, and obviously and famously has been happening for decades. But that's crippling to philosophical education for students. It's crippling for philosophical development for faculty, too. And it's much more at the teaching side there instead of the research side. It's turning philosophy more and more into a kind of deliverable product and a sort of anonymous thing. So I think, yeah, I mean, as you say, philosophical education and cultivation for those of us in professional philosophy would, I think, be better served by having more time to focus on continuing our own learning with a sense of a longer time frame in which we're going to produce so-called results, rather than churning out some publishable article this year, this year, this year. You might imagine that somebody's not going to publish anything, perhaps ever. Maybe their work will be in teaching or something. Or perhaps they'll write a book after 20 years, but it'll be a good book instead of the 20 articles that would have come out that will be sort of mediocre. By which I don't mean to denigrate the quality of the work people do. I mean, I think professional philosophers that I know are themselves, generally speaking, highly learned, very capable, very smart, very serious. And so the work that people do is as respectable as the work anywhere else. But I think in general, the philosophical discipline is not served as well by aiming for that result. It's not served as well as it would be if we did, as you say, for example, allow people more time to cultivate their own learning. And as I was saying also in teaching, you know, you can produce an environment that's much more conducive to philosophical learning of the students. Philosophy, again, isn't just a kind of information that one holds in one's mind or in one's head, you know. Philosophy is something that takes place in practice. It's we who want to know about our existence. And so philosophy is very much a matter of dialogue and communal investigation. And so philosophy is realized in collaboration between advanced thinkers who are jointly taking on a project. It's realized in the collaboration of teachers and students in the classroom and so on. So I think, yes, there are many ways to encourage, cultivate, and support philosophy that would be quite different than the general institutional structures that we currently operate in. And I think there'd be two big ones. The one you mentioned, which would be greater emphasis on time spent in cultivating long-term insight, and greater emphasis on smaller numbers of people involved in research and in teaching. And that's two sides. Smaller numbers of people in the classroom, so one teacher dealing with fewer students. I guess the other side, I might have said, more room for collaboration between people actually doing research so that we don't just think of everybody as doing philosophy on her or his own. I, for example, for quite a few years, have tried to develop a kind of ongoing philosophy workshop in Toronto where various people from North America come typically every summer to spend a couple of weeks jointly doing some study. So, you know, that's a group of maybe 20 people. And we study together, and a tremendous amount is learned by all of us in doing that. So our philosophical practices are not just individual. They're really ways that we collaboratively pursue our collective education and pursue advancing our philosophical insights.
And I think what you say suggests that maybe philosophy might be best done if it could maybe extend outside the academy and get to the public more directly.
Yeah, I think that's very true. You know, again, going sort of like your point about specialization, I mean, there is a reason why there are academies. There is a reason why philosophy and other studies have been brought out of just the broad public world and put in specialized institutions because people need to do specialized work. So by no means am I critical of the existence of the independent institutions of learning at our universities and so on. In fact, I wish those things were better supported. I wish they were more and that they were stronger. So I'm all in favor of magnifying the autonomy of the university, magnifying the autonomy of researchers in the universities, and not turning around and saying, oh, university, you must prove to me that you are speaking to the public with this. I think that there's great reason for establishing what one might even call an ivory tower, so to speak, but which I just mean a specialized area of study that operates according to the demands of its own autonomous needs. At the same time, I think it's true, and this is where people often criticize the ivory tower, I think it's very true that those things that are developed in educational institutions to be effective do need to be communicated. And so rather than wanting to dismantle the autonomy of the university, I would say it would be very good if that could be supplemented to have more ways in which there could be greater public activity. People have various small-scale ways of doing that, you know, having a for example, in the Department of Guelph, we have a regular situation where philosophy professors go out and give public talks. And I think that's a great way to reveal to the community that philosophy is relevant. And, you know, people from the community come to those talks, and they're interested in the things that academics do. And there is room for a real vibrant interchange between the especially academic community and the non-academic community. I think it's great, those things that we already do, and I think there could be more of those. So I think there is real room for a much greater participation of intellectual life in broader communal life. I think it would be great to have that enhanced. Exactly the ways to do it, I don't immediately have an answer to, although I don't think it's hard to come up with ways if there were support. I mean, things generally cost money. It would be nice if educational funding supported that more and so on. But yes, I mean, after all that, I would just go back to your initial question and say, yes, I think it would be very good if there were greater channels for participation between the specialized world of academic study and the broader community that is not especially academic.
I suppose another way of doing that is through writing. Books yep. that are not necessarily specifically targeted towards other scholars and other philosophers. And it seems to me that at least in a couple of your works, I'm thinking of Human Experience and Bearing Witness to Epiphany, you're kind of trying to do that.
Yes.
I mean, there's a conspicuous absence of footnotes.
Yes, that's right.
Which is a welcome thing, I think. You know, not to say that they're not rigorous and scholarly, but they're accessible.
Yeah.
And yes. are you deliberately trying to do that?
Very much. Okay. Very much so. So these two books and a couple of others that I'm working on right now are books that I wrote with that exact intention. The first book I wrote was a specialized study of the philosophy of Hegel. And, you know, like anybody who writes a first book, you know, I was proud of it and pleased with it, you know, published it and was, without ever having thought it through, I suppose I was sort of imagining I was going to see it on bookshelves. Of course, I'm not going to see it on bookshelves because it's a specialized study of the philosophy of Hegel and the number of people who are going to read that is very small. I remain happy to have done this work and I continue to publish books on Hegel and to do that kind of very technical, specialized work in philosophy. But I really didn't think that the ideas I was working with when I was studying Hegel, what I was learning, I thought these were the ideas of the most gripping importance for people in their lives. And so my sense was that here I am in my office or in my study carrel or at my computer or reading these books or whatever in the classroom, dealing with such powerful, gripping, and meaningful ideas. And yet, when I do the work to explain and develop those ideas aren't really going to other people in their everyday lives and not really communicating to the people who would be transformed by learning those things. When I published that book and had this realization, I thought the ideas here are so important that I should write so as to communicate these to the world of people who will not go to university and study Hegel, for example. And so Human Experience was the first book I wrote of that sort, and that was a book really about psychological health. You know, it was basically a book written to allow people to understand why they have hang-ups and how to think about them, where they come from, what to do about them. And indeed, I was talking a lot in that context about, in that book, I talk a lot about the impact of upbringing, the impact of participation in family life, and how that can have the effect of cultivating in us various sorts of hang-ups. But so this is also a book then for parents to say, be aware of what impact you might have on your children and, you know, how to be aware of that, how to be careful in upbringing so that you are not raising a child who's going to have troubles. You know? So I was trying, basically, in other words, my thought was that what I was learning in philosophy spoke to the very core of human psychology, the development of personality and human happiness, mental health. So I wanted to write a book to that effect. At the same time, I didn't want it to be the kind of book one can buy on the store and read through a bunch of watered-down ideas. I wanted it to be real philosophy because I also wanted it to be a book that reveals to people there's a reason to study philosophy. And because I'm a professional philosopher working in what I hope is, you know, frontline, cutting-edge research in continental philosophy, I wanted it to be a book that other people doing the same thing would also find worthwhile. So I tried to write to three audiences at the same time. I tried to write a book that had something to say to professional researchers in this area, and in that sense was not watered down, but was still rigorous, but was written in a plain enough way that someone without highly developed academic training could read it, and was written to speak to sufficiently intimate and important matters of everyday life that the points I would be making would be gripping to anyone. I'm trying to do that more and more with each passing book that I write, each subsequent book I write.
This concludes part one of my interview with Professor Russin. Please look for the continuation of this interview on our website, www.uoguelph.ca/philosophy, to appear soon.